Oh, okay. So thank you very much. So I was asked to give a tutorial on quantum error correction. I'm not sure if I'm the right person to do the tutorial because, well, quantum coding theory is my main research field, but at the same time, I sort of work by myself, so I sort of invented these techniques without reading papers. So my way of understanding is really non-standard, but well, we will see. But so the plan is the following. First half part of the talk, I will explain classical and quantum error correcting code, just basics, and then in the second part, I will try to ask questions. Like, there are several questions we quantum information theorists tend to ask, like what is the bounds on the amount of information you can store, or how to do computations, or how do we decode codes, and so on. Maybe these things may be interesting in the context of holography. So I try to introduce these questions and try to motivate maybe these questions in the context of holography. But
sorry to interrupt, but is there any way to get the microphone on?
Oh, the microphone just records. It doesn't amplify.
Okay, got it.
But I'm sure Benny can speak louder.
Yeah, maybe. I'll try. Okay. Okay, so let me start with codes. So I'll start with the classical code. So the idea of classical code is actually very easy. So let us look at one very famous example, that is repetition code. The idea is we encode information 0 or 1 into repetition 1 and 0s and 1s. And that's it. And so it's repetition. And why is this a good encoding? The reason is, suppose you start from old zero state. That's your encoding. And then you prepare this state, and let's say you leave the room. And then some error happens. Let's say these pins are flipped. Then we get this state, and then you come back to the room, and then you need to guess what was the original state. But you can easily guess the original state because, well, there are only two possibilities, all 0 or all 1. But if you look at the distance between this state and this state, this state and this state, this is much closer to this one. So we can reliably perform correction and then go back to the original encoded state. So that is very roughly speaking the essence of the error correction. And the reason why this error correction is possible is because these two code words are very separated from each other. In the technical world, we say that Hamming distance code words is large. Right. So by Hamming distance, I mean the number of different inputs or entries to the code word. So in this case, all the entries are different. So distance is just equals to n. N is the total number of spins in my system. OK, so this is the repetition code. I think the idea is very, very easy, right? But if you look at this repetition code, then you may notice that this repetition code can be realized as a Fermat domain by writing the following Hamiltonian. These are Pauli operators. And this ferromagnet Hamiltonian has two ground state, degenerate ground state, all zero state and all one state. So in this sense, ferromagnet realizes the code word space of the repetition code. It's a degenerate ground state with gapped Hamiltonian with a local interaction. And this way of viewing is very nice because here I wrote down the code word explicitly, like all 0 or all 1. But instead, I'm writing down the operators. That is, in order to specify the code, so we can characterize. Operators. That is, in order to specify the code, we just need to write down these interaction terms, zj, gj plus 1. Then this defines the code. So we don't need to write down the complicated code word in general. And this equation defines the code word of the repetition code. And this idea is quite nice because in this case, repetition code is very simple. But later, we will discuss quantum codes where it's very difficult to write down the wave function. So it's much more efficient to talk about operators. OK, but this is just a classical error correcting code. And it is not a good quantum code. So this is not a quantum code.
I'm sorry, can you explain what you mean by saying these operators characterize the code? I mean, so far you've defined two code words.
Mm-hmm.
Are the other things not considered code words? And what's the...
So maybe in the language of Hamiltonian,
yeah.
We can write down the following form of the Hamiltonian, where P is a tensor product of power theory operators. Then this Hamiltonian has degenerate ground states, mm-hmm. and then maybe more than two, like 4 or 8. And then, well, you can encode information to these degenerate ground state space.
But you only care about the ground state of this operator?
Right.
So there's multiple operators that would have mm-hmm. the same
ground. Multiple operators.
Well, you don't care what the eigenvalue is.
Oh, yes, yes, we only look at the... Mm-hmm.
And it is a degenerate ground state.
Degenerate
ground state. The entire degenerate subspace that's the mm-hmm. ground state mm-hmm. are things that we consider to be mapped back to this zero code word?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we're not trying to...
No, both are one. No, you're trying to define the two-dimensional subspace of the state space by giving a list of operators which fix that subspace. And so the more operators you give, the smaller the subspace will be.
But so far we've only given one operator.
No, he's not. He's every single term in that Hamiltonian fixes this space. The ZJ, ZJ plus 1s, all separately.
I see. So we care about the list of operators, not just the total Hamiltonian.
Well, that's right. Not what we're just told.
Okay. So the statement is that list of operators has exactly, leaves invariant exactly this two-dimensional subspace.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And for physicists, I guess we are interested in this PJ. Which are local, maybe geometrically local or local in the sense that it has low weight. I'll come back to that point. But that's one way of interpreting. So actually, at the classical level, all the coding theory, I mean, most of the coding theory happening by using these operators. And these are called the parity check operators in the context of classical coding theory. OK. But here, this is a classical code. It's obviously, it's classical. But I want to still argue that it is not a good quantum code to see this. Well, so I want to use this encoding. So I just put this wave function. But since quantum mechanics is linear, this means that if you have 0 plus 1 state, you are encoding this into a cat state. And this into another type of cat state. Oh no, sorry. Right. But as you know, this cat state is extremely unstable object. To see this instability more explicitly, assume that there occurs some single qubit error. So ZJ, so that's just one body operator acting on jth qubit. Then you notice that this plus cap will be transformed into minus cap. And this is my minus cap. So this is very problematic, because just a single qubit operator mixes these two code words. So it's not stable at all. And this is the basically the reason why this is not the quantum code. Well, it's sort of obvious, but this is how you see it. And again, I explicitly computed the way the code was transformed into Ethereum, but I can do this argument by using operators. And to do that, we will talk about physical operators. Now, I will define the logical operator later more precisely. But these are logical operators, essentially the symmetries of the Hamiltonian. One of the logical operators is this x1, x2, x3, dot, dot, dot. This operator, of course, commutes with the Hamiltonian. And also another logical operator is this one. Just a single body operator, which also commutes with the Hamiltonian. So these two operators preserve the ground state space. But the point is, they act non-trivially on ground state space. So this X bar operator is essentially the operator you needed to change from all zero state to all one state. And this Z bar is the operator which you needed to change from plus cap state to minus cap state. So in order for the system to work as a good quantum error correcting code, we want both X and Z operator to be big. But in this case, only X operator is very big, but Z is very small. So this is only a good classical error correcting code. Okay, so this is like
I'm sorry, what do you mean? You said X bar commutes with H, but X is very big? X bar is very big?
Uh-huh. It has lots of operators that aren't the identity. It acts non-trivially on all the qubits.
I see.
Right.
When you say a single qubit error, uh-huh. I should have thought ZJ would just change one of the bits.
Yes, just one of them. And so if I apply, let's say, Z1 operator to this state, then so 0000 stays to be 000, but 111 picks up minus one phase, so it changes to this one. Okay, so this is like the simplest example of a classical error correcting code, but this is too simple, and what classical coding theorists have been doing is basically they want to come up with a nice code. In this case, by code, I mean the choice log. This PJ operators, a set of operators, such that this code is good. By good code, I mean the following. So, for later purposes, let me introduce three parameters. By n, I always mean that the number of physical spins, or physical qubit in quantum settings. And k is the number of encoded logical bits. So this means that there are 2 to the k ground state. And D will be the distance. By distance, I mean the following. I list all the code words. So these dots represent sort of the code word in the space of exponentially big binary vectors. And this is the first code word. This is the second code word. And then there are 2 to the k code words, and then you can define the distance between each code word, the number of different entries, and by distance we mean the minimal Hamming distance that is defined as distance. And then by good code, we mean the following. K over N must be order 1. And B over N must be order 1.
So the code words are all things that are sequences of ones and zeros, or can they be more complicated quantum states?
It can be more complicated, well, classical states.
Have you defined the Hamming distance between things that are not just sequences of zeros and ones?
So given two code words, code word 1 and code word 2, the Hamming distance is essentially the number of entries which differ.
Yeah, but they can have superpositions.
This is entirely classical argument at this point. So it's pretty well defined.
We'll back to classical codes.
Okay. You can still ask whether a classical code is, whether a code that's classical in that sense can be compromised by quantum operators.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, in the quantum version, though, the distance is just how many Paulis do you have to act with to get from one code.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you pick into a state that has sort of in between 0 and 1 inner fraud output, which I assume would be bad, that you want to be the case that you act n times to get states orthogonal to all of the other.
So, okay, so I hope roughly the definitions are clear, right? So then by good code, we mean that we want to have a code with large number of ground states. So ground states are actually extensive degeneracy, and the distance is also, well, system size dependent. And well, the goal is to construct such PJ. And actually, it's very easy to achieve such a goal. You can just pick this PJ operator randomly, and then you can always achieve such a goal. But such an encoding is not so useful. The reason is, in order to decode the information, so suppose your original encoded state was this code word, and some error occurred. So now I'm in this state. So it's somewhere in the middle of the space. Then, in order to perform classical error correction, you need to look at the distance to each code word, right? And then you need to look at the minimal distance, and then you can decode the information. But there are, since 2 to the k degenerate ground states, so this task is very, very difficult. It takes exponential amount of time. So in this sense, random encoding is usually not efficiently decodable. So the goal is we want to construct PJ such that it admits efficient decoding. That is one of the difficult part of the theory of classical error correcting code. But there are many ways to construct such nice, good classical error correcting code. One way is called classical LDPC code. I'm not going to talk about details of classical LDPC code, but LDPC stands for low density pipe. And the idea is actually very easy. We just randomly pick PJ, but such that PJ is low weight. It turns out that such a code is a classical LDPC code and achieves a good rate. And such a code admits an efficient decoder. And this classical LDPC code was actually historically interesting because it was invented back in 1960s, but it was largely forgotten for 30 years or 40 years. But it's relatively, you know, recently this code was sort of reinvented, and the people realized the importance of this code.
So by low density, you mean small chance of getting a 1 instead of a
2. Right. So small weight operators.
It's the opposite, a large chance of having a, the P's are mostly 1s.
But what difference does it make what I call 0 and 1?
No, 1 means
one means there is an operator.
Yeah.
And 0 means there is
the operators, right? The P's are chosen.
Oh, then how do you work out the corresponding code.
Well, if you know all the P's, then you can.
So 0 means it's identity. 1 means there is operator, Z.
Yeah, right.
And the number 1 says small.
Right. By a random operator, you meant a random collection of sites to put a Z at?
Random collections of
the
sites to
the
put
a Z. The
operator
is all
yes.
product of Z's, and random,
yes.
Wait, operator means, let's say, we take 5 or something. And put
5 and random, six. Yes.
And the statement that with high probability, all of your code.
Yeah, high probability, which is. Well, I do not remember the details, but that like a failure probability goes to 0 exponentially, something like that.
And did the statement being exactly orthogonal with high probability, or just
exact,
or just close to orthogonal?
What do you mean by orthogonal?
It just involves z's, not x's.
Sure. For classical codes, isn't it just x's, not z's?
Just
well, okay, one.
Just x's. Just x's. The question is, each site, is there an x or not? That's the question.
We're doing z's here, right?
Z,
yes.
Any
operation
is well, it's
yeah, I guess we can pick one or the other. We just can't.
Right.
X's before.
Well, the point is that if you think in the quantum language, you want to pick the z operators to be the stabilizers, so the ones that specify what things are code words, mm-hmm. And your errors will be x's. So you have both, if you want.
In the quantum, yeah.
Okay, so that's all for classical things, but some people are already jumping ahead of try to talk about quantum things. So let's talk about quantum code. So in this tutorial, I will mostly concentrate on stabilizer code, which are perhaps the easiest class of quantum error correcting code. And instead of giving like a mathematical framework, I would like to stick to examples and then try to hint how to generalize the construction. So since Fernando will talk about holographic code later, so I would like to explain the very famous 5-qubit code. So we will see that this 5-qubit code, well, there are 5 qubits in total. It encodes 1 logical qubit, and the quantum code distance is 3. We will see that. Okay. So again, in order to specify the code, we will pick operators. In the case of 5-qubit code, so I will just write down the operators first. Okay, so these are the operators. Looks complicated, but it's just x, z, z, x, and you shift it. Shift it, shift it, shift it. And then that's the code. And first important observation is these operators commute with each other. How do we see that? Well, for example, about S1 and S2, so they commute because this x and I commute, z and z commute, I and x commute, but this part anti-commute, this part anti-commute. But the point is, here in this part you pick up -1 phase, here you pick up -1 phase, so they cancel with each other. So S1 and S2 commute. S1 and S3 also commute because anti-commutation and anti-commutation. And you can check that this is true for all S1, S2, S3, S. So they commute with each other. So this commutation is very nice because we can readily write down the following Hamiltonian, which we call stabilizer Hamiltonian. Then ground state of this Hamiltonian satisfies. So this equation basically defines the code word space of my quantum error correcting code.
How do we know there are only 4?
Sorry?
Why can't there be more?
Of course, you can add more, but if you add one more, then you lose the degeneracy. So in this case, there are 5 qubits, so there are 2 to the 5 state. But by putting one constraint, you are basically cutting the Hilbert space by half. So I have 4 operators, so 2 to the 5 divided by 2 to the 4, so there are 2 states. If you add one more, then there is only one state. So there are 2 states. So this means that k is equals to 1, because 2 to the 1 is equals to 2. OK, and so now I would like to sort of demonstrate that the chordal distance is equals to 3. Well, I haven't properly defined the chordal distance yet, but we will see what it means. So maybe I should not write here, or? I don't know.
It's okay.
Benny, can you ask me a question?
Yeah.
Even in the classical case, when you say k divided by n is order 1, suppose I'm working in the thermodynamic limit, n going to infinity, then this means that the number of ground states is exponential large size. But from a physical, if I'm implementing it in actual system, that requires long-range interactions, typically.
Yes. And
so then, what you're doing by this LDPC, because...
Okay, so I will go back to that issue later, but if you try to construct a local commuting, like this Z basis classical error correcting code on these space dimensions, you cannot have extensive design.
Exactly. Then how do people in practice have done all, I mean, people must be implementing this all the time in actual.
Oh, because I sort of motivated this by using Hamiltonian, but in reality, each spin is like each ferromagnet, so it's already very, very stable. So that error is, how can I say? So the information is not like protected by Hamiltonian.
I see.
But you send this information through some channels, and then these transmission errors, and then you.
So then it's not a good code in this sense. Then
yes.
The k is just equal to 2, yeah. Or 1 in that case.
Okay, so I want to show that the distance is 3. And to see this, I need to talk about logical operators. So I will denote logical operator by L. And this logical operator, as I discussed there, it needs to commute with the Hamiltonian. But it has some non-trivial action on the ground state space. This means that L should not be able to written as a product of S1, S2, S3, S4. And this bracket basically means the group generated by these 4 operators. So if this L is outside of S1, S2, S3, S4, the group, then this L will have a non-trivial action on the ground state space. And so let's construct such an example. And then it's very easy to construct, and because x bar is equals to, so if you look at this operator, then so they commute with S1, S2, S3, S4, right? What about z? Well, we can do the same thing. Then you can easily see that this x bar and z bar commute with the Hamiltonian. So this condition is satisfied. But how do we see this? The reason is because this x bar and z bar anti-commute with each other. So this wiggly bracket represents anti-commutation. And since S is an abelian group, and this is a sort of non-abelian, it's not non-commutative. This means that they must be outside of this group. Therefore, this is satisfied. So these are indeed the logical operators. And so here, well, maybe you want me to write down explicitly the these code words, but it's very difficult. That's exactly the reason why I'm using operators. So it's extremely difficult, and these code words are extremely highly entangled state, and it's very difficult to write it down. But by using these operator languages, it's very easy to characterize the code. Okay, so this is the code, and this is the logical operators. But you may say that this logical operator have 5 body, so it looks like the distance is 5, and it's actually a distance is still 3. The reason is this x bar operator and x bar times sj, these two operators act in the same way. C represents the code word space. The same operator, right? Because inside the ground state space or code word space, this sj is always equals to plus 1. So these two operators are the same. So they are equivalent to each other. This means that I'm allowed to multiply x bar operator by, let's say, s1. This gives me x times z is like y. So, well, I'm neglecting the global phase, which is not that important. So this is a three-body operator. You can do the same thing for z, and then you get It's weird. I see.
What distance are we computing? The distance between what two things?
Sorry?
What distance are we computing?
Also, the distance is actually the minimal weight of the possible logical operator.
But we're computing the maximum distance between any two vectors in the code subspace?
Yes.
Okay. Which is the diameter of the distance.
Yes, yes. Well, you pick two orthogonal state, and then you can compute the distance between these.
So the distance between any two orthogonal states and the preferred subspace is the same.
So, right. So what I want to show is, I pick up these logical operators, Pauli logical operators, and I want to show that they have weight at least 3. And from that information, actually, we can prove that there is no local three-body operator which can distinguish ground states.
So how is y defined?
Oh, 2, yes. Yes.
How is y defined?
Oh, y-bar operator, yes. One possibility is, of course, this one. But, of course, this is equivalent to this or this. And this x bar, z bar, y bar operators act as a Pauli x, y, z on the code word space at the level of logical qubits.
X times z
Yeah. So the distance is independent of the basis here. How does it? Can you define the distance in a
just
this is
that
limitation.
What is the? Oh, that's it. When you said that it's the size of the operator.
Right.
Do that sound like a basis independent definition? But can you again?
So let me denote the psi by this is a density matrix, and then this is a trace over the A bar. Then I mean that what I mean by the distance is you pick state from the code word space, and then you pick any pair of the states from the code word space, and then so this is essentially the definition of the distance. Okay, so since all these Pauli logical operators must have weight 3, this means that you have, let's say, logical 0 state, logical 1 state, then you need a 3-body operator to go from this state to this state. And this means that if your initial encoding is 0 state, and then if some single Pauli error happens, it will go to some e times 0 tilde, e is some single Pauli operator, then still this sort of distance is 1-body. So I still have at least distance 2 to 1 tilde. This means that there is a possibility of performing the correction and then trying to go back to the original encoded state. And this process is essentially the quantum error correction. And so I would like to explain how this works. So what we need to do first is
you mm-hmm. made was that x bar times s1 mm-hmm. acts non-trivially only on 3 qubits, mm-hmm. and yet what it does is it takes a state in the code space and maps it to an orthogonal state mm-hmm. in the code space, and the mm-hmm. reason why it does so is mm-hmm. because its action is exactly like x bar on the code space, mm-hmm. and we've seen before that x bar on the code space does acts non-trivially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, and you deduced without showing that that 3 is the minimal number.
Oh yes, I didn't. Yes. So I must mention that this 3 is the minimal number, and then it's something you need to actually convince yourself by applying many other S1, S2, S3, and but well, there are many ways to prove it, but that's something you can maybe convince yourself.
Well, you will convince us because you're going to show us how to correct for qubit error, single qubit errors. Right?
Oh, that's actually one. Yeah. Yes. That's one proof. Yes. Right. But I mean, there are many proofs. Okay. So I want to perform error corrections, and what I will do is I will measure stabilizer operators S1, S2, S3, S4. So in the language of quantum coding theory, this is called syndrome measurement. And then after this measurement, I will get some binary numbers. So these are the measurement results, which are either +1 or -1. So this is just some example. And then the goal is, given this measurement result, we need to deduce the error operator E, and then undo this error operator, and then go back to the original encoded state. And fortunately, this is possible if this E is a single qubit error. And to do this, what we typically do is we construct a sort of error and syndrome measurement table. So suppose your error, I mean, if there is no error at all, then right? So there is no error. Then there is no syndrome with minus one. But if some x error occurred to my system at the first qubit, then this will flip the sign of syndrome. So in this case, let's say x anti-commute with S4, so something like this. If this was the error, then you can basically construct such a table. But the point is, there are in total 16 possible errors. That is, I have three possible power errors, This is one. One means there's no error. And then three times five. So this is 16. On the other hand, at the syndrome part, we have 16 possible measurement results. And it turns out there is a one-to-one correspondence between them. So given syndrome measurement error, measurement result, you can always deduce the single qubit error. And then you can undo the error operation. And then this is how you can perform error correction. So this type of error correction is easy because this is 5-qubit code. So you can explicitly write down such a table. But if the number of qubits increases, then making this table and looking at this table is very, very, very difficult, especially because there are exponentially many types of errors. I mean, in this case, I'm correcting only single qubit errors, but if I want to correct many qubit errors, then this table becomes exponentially big. So again, the decoding typically becomes very difficult.
Is E allowed to be a superposition of X and Z on a single qubit?
Yes, but because the syndrome measurement is like a measurement, so it's sort of a collapses the wave function.
And that process doesn't do anything destructive, you don't need to be relation by that. How do we see that the measurement part doesn't lose anything important?
Because right, so for example, my error is like a superposition X and Y, and then
So you can think about it as postponing the measurement of a logical operator. So you have these stabilizer operators that all commute with each other and commute with the logical operators. So quantum mechanics tells you that you should be able to measure them all simultaneously without disturbing the others. So now you postpone the measurement of the logical one, and you know that you haven't actually perturbed the outcome of that measurement. You can measure all the stabilizers without perturbing the...
I think the important thing is that the product of the stabilizer with an error still commutes with the logical operators. So that you can undo the error without corrupting the coherence of the code subspace. This question is important because this is what it means for it to be correctable: is that these measurements don't disrupt the superposition of the code subspace. So if you'd written down 2-qubit errors, it wouldn't have worked. If you combine those with stabilizers, you can get in trouble.
You said any 1-qubit error times a stabilizer is what property?
Commutes with all the logical operators.
I see.
So.
Why can't one do this for 2-qubit error as well? Yeah. No. You can have just S1, S2, and S3 rather than S1, S2, S3, and S4.
So, sorry?
So. Instead of working with 4 stabilizers, why don't you work with 3 stabilizers, S1, S2, and S3?
S1, S2, S3, and then, so then you are encoding 2 logical qubits. Yes.
Yeah, and then 2-bit error can be.
So, right. So, if you only use S1, S2, S3, then there are only like 8 possible measurement results, right? Then there are already 16, so.
More, actually.
Or more, yeah.
I was confused by the statement. The errors times the stabilizer, those commute with the logical operators?
Maybe I said it wrong. The important thing is you do this measurement of the stabilizers, and then you're left with the state acted on by some error which you know. And so then you can just undo the error and come back to the original state.
And that's just this collapsing away function.
Yeah, that's the collapsing
away function. So I thought that was sufficient.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sufficient. So yeah. So maybe we should just say it that way. I'm not sure if the other thing I said was right.
Okay.
I think it's worth clarifying. I mean, this does, you know, this is, I think Don also was confused about this. I mean, this makes it sound like the distance is 2, right? So, because
Right.
So it's important that you're talking about arbitrary errors here, right?
Yeah, yes, arbitrary errors, and then I also don't know what kind of errors happen. So, for example, if we think about erasure errors,
yeah,
and then that is, I have 5 qubit, then for some reason I lose, let's say, 2 qubit. Then in this case, since I know the location of errors, then I can just measure a logical operator which is supported on.
Yes. So that's what the distance is most closely related to in the way that you define it.
Yes. So these are called erasure errors, but in this case, I'm not assuming anything about the knowledge on the errors. So this is probably the most severe type of error. So in general, if distance is d, then we can correct up to d minus 1 over 2 errors. In this setting. Okay, so I explained that the error can be corrected, but it's a bit sounds maybe restrictive because I can only correct single qubit errors, but it's still okay in the following sense. That is so now I'm going to talk about something called the threshold theorem. Well, it's called threshold theorem, but I actually don't know the precise statement of threshold, so let me just call it error threshold. So as I said, assume that some Pauli error, I don't know if it's X or Y or Z, but some Pauli error with probability P of each qubit. That is, I have 5 qubit, and then with probability P, some error occurs to first qubit. With probability P, some error goes to second qubit, and so on. And then the question is, can we still recover the original information or not? And then, well, so probability of successfully decoding the correct information is, of course, the case with no error. That is this one. And the case with single qubit error. That is this one, right? Then you can just compute this, and then it turns out this looks like this. 1 minus 10 times p squared and higher order terms. Now, right now I'm assuming that p is very small, so this is sort of negligible. So probability of failure is roughly the order of 10 times p squared, right? So this means that if p is smaller than some threshold value, which is nearly equals to 1 over 10, then this failure rate becomes smaller than the original error rate p. So by doing this encoding, actually I'm lowering the error rate. So in this sense, there is a merit of using this quantum error collecting code. But still, there is a finite failure error rate. So eventually, we want to reduce this failure error rate to very, very close to zero. And in order to do this, we typically use the idea of concatenation of the code. That is, in the setting of 5 qubit, it's actually looks like meta, in a sense that so you can view this as a tensor network representing the 5 qubit. This is a logical qubit, like you prepare the logical information zero, and then you get the output. But the idea is, and then, so this logical qubit, so we will do the higher hierarchical encoding with respect to logical qubit. That is, we do this, and then you can keep doing this. Then the point of doing this is, if I have some late p error at each qubit at the lower level, at the level of the first layer of the logical qubit, this error rate becomes the order of 10 times p squared. And then the second layer, it becomes smaller, smaller, smaller. So by doing this hierarchical construction, the error rate can go to exponentially close to zero. And this is essentially the statement that this quantum error collecting code has an error threshold. That is, a failure rate can go asymptotically zero as the system size goes to infinity. Okay, then finally, so is this clear, or hopefully, yeah. Finally, I would like to talk about this local indistinguishability. So far, I haven't defined the distance in a very rigorous way, but the way we would define the distance is the following. So here, by psi, I mean the reduced density matrices version of the psi state, and the psi A is its the traced out version, and then so this basically defines the code distance. And this is called the local indistinguishability. And well, in a more physicist-friendly language, this means that the reduced density matrices are exactly the same on local region A. This means that there is no local order parameter to distinguish different ground states. So essentially, this is same as saying that there is no local order parameter in this system.
Is there a choice of any?
It is any local region which is smaller than the distance. And typically, for good quantum code, D is as big as the system size. So
A is local. It's not any three qubits, for example. It's three that are next to each other.
It depends on the code, but in the case of the 5-qubit code, so since distance is 3, so I can pick any region with 2 qubits.
Right.
This is okay. This is also okay.
But a minute ago you said A is a local region. I didn't understand what you meant by that.
Oh, local, by which I mean just the number of supports, so number of qubits on A.
I mean, it's a subfactor that respects the physical factorization into the physical qubits.
Some selection of those qubits.
Yeah, some selection of those qubits.
Okay.
not necessarily connected or close.
Not necessarily spatially near each other.
Now, I would like to prove this statement in the case of the 5-qubit group. So, the proof is actually very easy. So, first I consider some state, which is, of course, a code word state. So, it satisfies the following. But now, first I will concentrate on the state, which is stabilized by a power Z operator. So it's like a logical zero state. Now let's compute the reduced density matrix for this psi. And then, very nice thing about the stabilizer formalism is that this reduced density matrices can be, matrix can be easily written in the following way. That is, five qubits. Okay, so why is this true? Because S1 times is equals to, I mean, 1 means identity. Right, because S1 is a Pauli operator, so if you square it, you get identity. So this is S1 plus identity. Similarly, this is also equal. So because of this, you notice that this state satisfies this, these conditions. Now given these descriptions of reduced density matrices, it's pretty easy to compute psi A by tracing out so to do this we observe that the trace of the Pauli operator is equals to zero. So in order to have non-trivial contribution to this trace, we need to have a Pauli operator. So by multiplying these terms, you get basically Pauli operators. But what you need is a Pauli operator, which has no support on A bar. Right. Right, so wait, what do I want to do? Let's see. Yes. So this thing is identity because there is no such Pauli operator you can construct. And this statement is true regardless of the choice of the Pauli operators, which means that if this is true for this psi, then this is true for another phi, and so on. So in this case, actually, all the reduced density matrices are equals to identity matrices, and this is true.
For
a bar less than more than or equal to 3. Yes. I was saying the same thing. Okay, good. Okay, so this is like a quick summary of the basics of the quantum error correcting code. And is there any question at this point? Or
I guess I will ask one question. So you mentioned you introduced the social distance. Mm-hmm. What you're really interested in is how many multi-body errors you can correct without mm-hmm. knowing where the errors are. Mm-hmm. And this metric distance doesn't measure exactly that. But is there any relation between them? I mean, if this distance is 17 million, can I say that I can correct at least 2-body errors or anything of that kind?
So you're saying distance is very big, right?
The question is, you have notion distance. You said that it doesn't precisely say that the distance is d, I can correct errors in d minus 1 bodies. But if the distance is very big, it doesn't mean I can correct.
I thought you said you could do d minus 1 over 2.
Right.
You can do d minus 1 over 2?
Because there is no e of. Yes, yes.
Okay. I missed that.
You can do d minus 1 erasures and d minus 1 over 2 arbitrary errors.
You're right.
Very good.
Right. Okay, so.
So you have plenty of time. Maybe this is a good point to check in and see how far along in your planned talk we can.
So this is the part I definitely needed to talk, probably, because it's the basic. But for later part, I basically want to pose questions. So.
So if we go on for another 20 minutes or so.
Right. Actually, for the second part, I'm not that well prepared, so. The plan was I ask questions and then maybe someone can answer. Right, so apparently Fernando is going to talk about gates. So I'm not going to talk about gates. So I will try to talk about decoding and the bounds. By bounds, what do I mean by that? Well, there are many interpretations, many ways of asking questions. But basically, in the context of quantum error correcting code, let's say in the context of stabilizer formalism, we have such Hamiltonian. And then we can ask how many qubit you can encode. That's k. This is the distance. So it's more like a resilience against noises. And we want to make k and d, both of them, to be very, very big, while n is fixed. But we want to ask this question in a more physically reasonable setting. And one way of doing this is to impose locality on the stabilizer generators. And this basically gives you the definition of a quantum LDPC code. And there have been many researches on quantum LDPC code recently. And there is a particularly nice one, which is k is order of n. The distance is only log n. So it's a very high rate code, and the distance is only logarithmic. But still, if you think about random errors, this code is known to have a finite error threshold. And this code is actually essentially the toric code, but defined on a hyperbolic space.
I'm sorry, the statement locality on Sj?
Is that Sj is just low weight operators, finite weight operators.
Finite.
But I don't assume anything about the underlying geometry of them.
Finite means order of one.
Order one.
But it's the toric code, you do assume something about the geometry, right?
But you can embed like a graph on the hyperbolic space, and then.
But on the hyperbolic space, still don't. By the toric code on hyperbolic space, do you still just mean Z2 lattice gauge theory on hyperbolic?
Yes. But in some sense, that how can I say, the density of the qubits sort of grows, and you cannot embed it in a flat.
Oh, but that's certainly true.
So in that sense, it's not.
Oh, but to a physicist, it should still be called local. I mean, it's.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm calling it local. So okay. Local Sj. So. Yeah. So that's one way of creating such a quantum LDPC code. So, right.
Can you remind me what weight is toric is defined?
The weight is the number of Pauli operators. In Sj.
No identity.
No identity. Yeah. I mean, it's just a toric coordinate, so it's like three body or four body, five body. But another kind of question we can ask is, of course, in this sense, it's local in the sense of SJ, but maybe we want to ask local on the graph. That is, you consider some fixed lattice geometry in this partial dimension, and you want to ask how many qubits can be encoded and how robustly you can encode. And for that setting, actually, there is a known bound. In the classical setting, the bound was yes, this is the bound. And in the quantum setting, this is the bound. So capital D is the spatial dimension. This moment. And so at this moment, for this classical bound, we already know how to saturate the bound. So there is an example of classical code, which actually what I found in my paper, but k is order of l to the d minus 1, l is the linear length of the lattice, and then d is order of epsilon is some arbitrary small constant. So in some sense, this scaling is like holographic. But this part is known, but for this one, we still don't know what kind of quantum error correcting code can saturate the bound. So these are the results known in the context of quantum error correcting code, especially from these constraints on SJ. But maybe one interesting question to ask in the context of holography is to ask similar question in the context of ADS CFT as a quantum error correcting code. And I don't have any particular problem setting to talk about. I have no result. But the way of interpreting this holographic quantum error correcting code is you have a fixed geometry background, and then you put, so in the language of tensor network, it's open legs, but it's like you are putting matter on the box. And then given this operator, there's a possibility of doing causal or entanglement wedge reconstruction of the operators. But maybe we can ask constraints on the k, the number of logical qubits, and d, the distance, in the context of ADS CFT correspondence. That is, for instance, in order for this system to admit code interpretation, you don't want to distort the geometry. That is, you fix the geometry first, and you put matter. So that may give you some constraint on k. Also, the constraint on D is like, how can I say? So if you pick up this region A, if you do something here, then local observer who has access on A cannot see the effect of this operation. This means that for bulk people, someone on the bulk, you want to put some energy or some matter on the bulk. That there is something here. So such a thing may be able to put some constraints on the distance on the and so these are the viewpoint from bulk, but maybe you can ask a similar question from CFT side. That is, from CFT side, basically you start from vacuum of the CFT, and you want to apply an operator to the vacuum of the CFT, such that these two states are different, possibly orthogonal, but they have the same reduced density matrices locally. But I don't know how to construct such operator from purely from CFT language.
What are the constraints on the operator that you're looking for?
So sorry?
What are the constraints on the operator that you're looking for?
So by applying this U operator, I go to an orthogonal state, possibly. But if I look at the local reduced density matrices of these two states, they look identical to each other.
Okay, just the logical operator.
Just the logical operator, but I want to do it for the vacuum with CFT and then. So, especially how to construct such operators, very, at least I do not know. So basically the number of operators you can construct probably gives you some idea about K. And also maybe D. But in order for this to be possible, this operator U must be very, very complicated, I guess. Because, well, otherwise vacuum, the boundary observer can easily see it.
Well, I mean, the construction of Hamilton, Kubota, Lipschitz, and Lowe does this. Right?
Okay.
That was sort of the starting point of this whole idea.
Oh yeah, I see.
That we know how to write down these operators.
I don't know.
By solving bulk wave equations.
So, how do you do it? Purely from CFT?
Yeah. So you solve them as operator equations in the CFT.
Mm-hmm.
So it produces operators which are local in the CFT if you include operators integrals over time. But if you look at them in a fixed time, they're very complicated.
But
you can write them down by writing them down in terms of Heisenberg picture operators at different times.
You can do it for the causal wedge.
Yeah, you can do it for the causal wedge. That's right. Well, here I was even just saying the global reconstruction is good enough. So then the ADS Rindler reconstruction, that is an explicit realization of this.
Right.
But it, so far it works only in the causal wedge. I mean, so the challenge is to come up with a formula that works also in the entanglement wedge. That's what we don't know how to do.
I see. Mm-hmm. So. But I
Yeah. Does this translate to a question about quantum error correction per se? If you can translate it, leaving out the CFT language?
It's roughly related to this question of whether or not it's quantum secret sharing, or whether or not there's a threshold, for the code that's like for an operator in the center that having two regions which are disconnected is just as good as having one region which is connected. I mean, that using the methods that I was just describing, that it's not just as good.
Well, you just phrased it in terms of that language, but you're still appealing the properties of the CFT specifically.
Well,
I think she was asking whether you could just reduce it to some conjecture that was purely mathematical type codes, and I don't.
This is a question about the specific code provided by ADS CFT, right? I mean, we know there are codes with thresholds.
So that's my point, we need to understand ADS CFT better to know what code we're talking about to answer the question.
So it's
not a purely information theory question how how to translate ADS CFT.
I was just trying to translate theory. The question into information theoretic terms.
So actually, I'm curious in what conditions this finding such operator is possible. Probably it's not possible for, let's say, free CFT, right?
No, it's not. There has to be a large N CFT.
Yeah, right. So that's one criteria.
But that's understood. So
the large N and free are not.
Holographic CFT.
That means something specific, though, right? It means that the scaling of the correlation function, of the low point correlation functions of the CFT with N is highly constrained, so that you can roughly compute higher point functions by weight contraction up to higher order corrections of 1 over N.
Okay.
So you'd include something like symmetric orbifolds?
I would not actually. I think the essential thing is that, for me at least, is that there aren't too many low dimension operators. I mean,
That's true. In that one,
there's not a gap. So the idea is that the low dimension spectra of the CFT is just single trace operators. They're multi trace combinations and descendants, and that there's some order one number of them. And so if you have all those properties, then you can prove that the Kubota, Lipschitz, and Lowe construction produces operators which obey the axioms of effective field theory in anti-de Sitter space. I mean, for example, in n equals 4 supernormals, we know it does have these properties, so then we really know, like, there's no assumptions here.
You mean you can prove it leading order?
No, but using supersymmetry, right? Because the dimensions of the operators are protected, the chiral VPS operators, I guess I'm assuming that there aren't other non-supersymmetric low-dimension operators sitting around.
Well, there are. You're doing weak coupling theory.
No, but we're not. No, we're not. No, the point is we're doing large lambda, and then, for example, you can study this using integrability.
Okay, in that limit, I understand.
Yeah. That's the limit. I mean, that is definitely the limit. Large lambda and large n.
The HKL doesn't itself assume supersymmetry.
No, but for the consistency of the 1 over n corrections to work, you need the OPE of the operators to have the right form, and it won't if you don't have large lambda, because there will be other low-dimension operators around that can run in the four-point function that won't be described by bulk effective field theory. But I mean, all that doesn't help with the entanglement wedge theory.
Okay. Yeah. But well, maybe in the context of CFD, so maybe the solution is obvious. I don't know. But I mean, purely from, like, let's say I assume that let's say 1D local Hamiltonian, and I look at the vacuum, and then whether I can find such operator or not is at least very non-trivial problem to me. Yeah. So I want to have some, like, a simple criteria to tell if this is possible or not, like maybe some, like, an inequality type.
Well, I think there are these criteria on the spectrum of primary operators.
Well, yeah, in CFD, but
okay. You would like those criteria to be translated into some statement.
No. I just gave you some wave function.
Yeah.
Just 1D wave, 1-dimensional wave function, and then I want to ask if this type of finding operators possible or not. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah.
I was wondering about this ending. I mean, even in this HKL case, I guess the operator that you act with on the vacuum will raise the energy a little bit. The operator will raise the energy of the state a little bit.
Right.
That's something that you could detect locally.
Right. That's actually one thing I actually wanted to ask someone. So, right. So if I apply, let's say, some local operator and they inject some little bit of energy, then I time evolve it, then probably it will diffuse into the entire system. If this energy is very, very tiny, then this energy, after spreading, this energy is very low, so maybe it's not detectable for local observer. But in order for this construction to work, maybe this CFD or whatever the Hamiltonian must be scrambling. So
I was wondering if you could have a different condition that you just have, like, mm-hmm. let's say we had U1 and U2, mm-hmm. which were different operators that sort of both raise the energy by the same amount,
mm-hmm.
and then you would say that those things were really locally
indistinguishable. Oh, so you want, right. I see.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's helpful for what you want to show, but it seems like something that mm-hmm. has a better chance of being exactly true.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is related to the fact that this gravitational dressing, you know, there aren't really local operators, right? So you have to just move the goalposts a little bit to mm-hmm. what you really want at higher orders than one. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think HKL takes care of that kind of automatically.
What is H?
Oh, it's just the algorithm I mentioned.
Oh,
it's expecting the operator. So it'll know that they can't commute with the Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
So in what sense does it take care of that automatically?
Well, and you know perfectly well right, I mean, because, you know, you have your theory you're dealing with is a gauge theory, and the bulk of the homomorphism invariant. Mm-hmm. And so when you define gauge invariant operators, they're not going to be local.
Right. Yeah. Well, but you're saying HKL
knows that because you're solving diffeomorphism invariant bulk equations of motion to construct yeah. gauge invariant operators.
Okay.
So there will always be gravitational Wilson lines or what have you.
Yeah, it accounts for the dressing.
It accounts for that, yeah. So for example, if you work in holographic gauge, then there are non-local commutators. I learned that from ITSA. Is ITSA here? Mm-hmm.
He's doing well physics.
I know, but he's still here, though, isn't he?
Can't suck him back in.
Well, anyway, so that's some of the questions maybe we can ask in the context of holography. Mm-hmm. And then, so, okay, I'll just briefly mention decoding problem. So I have been talking about decoding and as if decoding is a very difficult task. And then in some sense, it's true, but in quantum coding theory, we already have many, many nice, efficient decoding algorithms. And so in this, let's say, this concatenated code, decoding is pretty easy because we first collect errors at this lower level, and then we go to the next step and then do the error correction in a hierarchical way. But in some sense, this looks like a coarse graining. And in fact, our holographic code is essentially we connect these tensors in a more natural way, in a sense that it's a more natural hyperbolic tessellation. So it has some tree-like mirror structure. So in a similar way, you can do the error correction, starting from the bulk side, the boundary side, and then going to the interior. So in some sense, this decoding has some interpretation as an RZ flow. So I'm curious, purely from boundary viewpoint, this error correction or decoding, the meaning, especially in the language shift, it may be something interesting to explore. But I have, at this moment, I do not know, but maybe that's something interesting to look at. So, and then finally, logical gates, that's something Fernando will talk about. But this is a question you ask when you want to do quantum computation inside the ground state of the quantum error correcting code. So suppose you are already in the ground state of some Hamiltonian, but you want to go to another ground state of the Hamiltonian. Well, you can easily do Pauli X rotation, but if you want to do just a small theta rotation, how do you do that? It's actually very difficult. It takes a long amount of time to do that. And these constraints are known as the Easting-Kuhn theorem, but which is very related to the existence of the global symmetry in the Hamiltonian. So I guess these things Fernando will talk about. Anyway, so that's it for the tutorial. So thank you very much.